Welcome to the podcast service of the Massachusetts Climate Action Network. Visit us online at massclimateaction.net or friend us on Facebook.
Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of April 19th, 2016. That's known as Tax Day here in Massachusetts, because we get an extra day because of Patriots Day. Anyway, we're joined today by our frequent guest, the prolific commentator, Mr. D.R. Tucker. How are you doing, D.R.?
Doing great. How are you doing?
Great. So, D.R., as always, things are chugging along in the climate world. But one of the things that's chugging along is a case that you and I have touched on multiple times now over the course of the last, 18 months or so? Mm-hmm. And this is the concept of a legal concept called the public trust, where there's this ancient, literally ancient, legal doctrine that says the government has responsibility to nurture and take care of certain geophysical things, rivers and waterways and whatnot. And it's called the public trust doctrine because these places, like the middle of the Mississippi River, is held in trust by the government for all of us. Anyway, that public trust doctrine has been taken up by various people, in particular young kids who are suing the government over its failure to protect the public trust in the long run. Right, D.R.? So tell me, something big happened this week. Can you fill me in?
Yes, a federal magistrate judge rejected a motion by the defendants in a lawsuit in the Our Children's Trust lawsuit, the lawsuit filed by 21 youths in Oregon, challenging the federal what they claim is the federal government's failure to aggressively move to curb carbon pollution. The magistrate judge, I believe his name is Thomas Coffin, refused to throw out the case, saying that basically the plaintiffs deserve to have their day in court. And considering the contentious nature of the issue, this case merits being heard. Now, it has been noted in only a few news reports, and I think it's very strange that only a few news reports noted this, that a supervising federal judge, Ann Aiken, has to review Judge Coffin's ruling and clear it before a trial can go forward. Mm-hmm. And obviously, if that federal judge rules that Judge Coffin got it wrong, there's no trial. And also, we should also warn again that just because Judge Coffin ruled that the plaintiffs have a right to have their day in court does not mean that they will ultimately win the case. And we've discussed previously the number of cases going all the way back to the late 2000s, the Kivalina versus Exxon case and the Comer versus Murphy Oil case, where plaintiffs who have tried to hold either governments or fossil fuel companies responsible for the damage caused by climate change have lost. Mm-hmm. So this is the first of what could potentially be many steps, and some of those steps may have disappointing results. So a bit of cautious optimism.
But I think that I am going to be wildly optimistic in contrast, DR. We've spoken before about, this is a legal challenge by children on this principle of this public trust doctrine, and they've lost. And I think you and I have on this show said, in these legal matters like this, you keep losing until you start winning. Right. Mm-hmm. And this is clearly a step in the right direction, even if the public trust case in this instance is overturned by the supervising judge. Still in all, you've made it one step further in terms of the credibility of the public trust doctrine as a legal principle as it applies to climate. And one of the reasons I think it's so important is because when the courts if this went all the way to the Supreme Court, I suppose, ultimately. But the idea that the federal government has a responsibility to protect the air, it's a different thing than talking about legislation, right? It's a whole new ball game because the Supreme Court says you will have marriage equality. Well, you're going to have marriage equality, right? Because the court has ruled that way. So I think it's a great step in the right direction. I appreciate your, maybe you're being, cautious because you're so hopeful. But I think it's a great, great thing.
Well, I was discussing this with a friend after the ruling came down. And I was saying that, you know, I was discussing that previous case, the Alec Lors versus Lisa Jackson case, where a federal judge threw out the case saying that, you know, in essence, that judges can't substitute themselves for the EPA. And I was saying that I think that one of the reasons why I'm skeptical about a favorable ruling if this does go to trial is that what specifically is the relief being sought by the plaintiffs? Do the plaintiffs want, for example, the federal courts issuing a ban on fracking? I would love to see that, but I doubt the courts will do that. Do they want a federal injunction banning, you know, basically forcing the shutdown of all coal-fired power plants? I would love to see that, but I doubt the courts will do that. So what specifically is being requested? And then this hinges on the same issue that was brought up in the Alec Lors versus Lisa Jackson case. Are federal judges qualified to determine what is the proper amount of CO2 in the atmosphere? Federal judges, I can't think of any federal judge, even the most environmentally concerned federal judge, who has the expertise of a climate scientist.
Right.
And that's where we get into these sort of tricky issues with the courts. While the goal is laudable to try to get the courts to do what legislators will not, nevertheless, it always comes on these tricky and very thorny legal grounds of what specific relief is being requested.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're a smarter guy than I am. I take your point. That's right. I mean, so it's like the dog that chases the bus, right? Once the dog catches the bus, what's he going to do with it? So, all right. Well, anyway, I think you're also right that this is kind of a procedural victory. That is to say, this case now gets to go to a trial, right? Mm-hmm. And the success or failure in the trial is an entirely different question, right? I mean, but, well, DL, we will see. I guess that's the interesting thing. We will be watching these kinds of developments, and hopefully within 6 months or so, we'll have the next step in this, right? We'll see who's coming out ahead there.
As the old saying goes, the whole world is watching.
The whole world is watching. So let's come back to Massachusetts for a minute. Here in Massachusetts, everyone should remember that there are there's an omnibus, as we say, the Omnibus Energy Bill, which is a big bill that has lots of parts in it that relate to energy, and of course, energy and climate are tightly linked. So the Omnibus Energy Bill could be kind of an Omnibus Climate Bill at the same time. Last week we talked about how the photovoltaic policy portion got sort of stripped out to stand on its own. I believe we're going to find out that bill got signed this week, but there's also the solar bill got signed, but also the omnibus bill, the omnibus energy bill, is still being thrashed about. But there seems to be a forming opposition to a provision of the bill that would essentially ask electricity ratepayers to pay for new pipelines. Right, DR, have you seen anything about that?
Yes, that's correct. It was reported in the Springfield Republican that over 90 lawmakers on a bipartisan basis sent a letter to House Speaker Robert DeLeo asking him to make sure that the Omnibus Energy Bill does not include a de facto tax for natural gas pipeline expansion. The natural gas companies want to impose this tax to pay for pipelines that Attorney General Maura Healey has said we don't even need. Mm-hmm. And these 90 legislators wrote this letter saying, quote, "We ask you to ensure energy legislation does not commit ratepayers to bearing the cost and risk associated with financing new gas infrastructure because substantial new pipeline infrastructure is inconsistent with our shared goals," unquote. So again, it's good to see that a significant portion of these legislators spanning the state have basically recognized that this is a form of taxation without representation.
Right. I mean, 90, I think it's 150 people in the House of Representatives. So if you've got 90 of them on an issue, let's hope that holds up, right? This is where the horse trading begins. But it's a good thing. I mean, we certainly, and just to remind everybody, the issue is that the utilities want to have the pipelines paid for by the ratepayers. The utilities claim that the pipelines will help Massachusetts meet its energy needs, but a realistic look at the pipeline suggests that the utilities really want to export the gas off to Canada. And so the insult to the injury is that you're going to pay for a pipeline that someone else is going to make money off of by exporting.
And you mentioned that, you know, the amount of legislators we have. If you think about it, all of them should be against this, because why should anybody be supporting, for all intents and purposes, welfare for the gas company?
Yeah. I'm with you. So speaking of oil and gas companies, I just want to note in passing that there was a leak on the Keystone XL pipeline. And we don't have to, but I mean, it was initially said to be something like 100 gallons, and it turned out to be 87,000 gallons of Keystone XL pipeline goop bubbling up under the prairie out there somewhere. Mm-hmm. And without, you know, we've been around Keystone a lot, but you know, this idea that Keystone would never have leaked is not true, because it's leaking now, right?
It makes you wonder why they call it light sweet crude. It's actually dark and sour crude, if you think about it.
So I guess the I just wanted to throw in one other thing that I found fascinating is the following idea that was reported in Grist. The following thing is reported in Grist that the – so before I even go there, let me say that most people may not realize it, but there is a distinction between the magnetic North Pole and the true North Pole. Okay, so the true North Pole is that little line that you see in the textbook about which the Earth is spinning, right? That's the axis of spin. Mm-hmm. But it turns out inside the middle of the Earth, there's a lot of molten rock and stuff, okay? And that, and since the Earth is spinning, that molten rock is kind of spinning around, and that makes a magnetic field. Now, generally, we don't have to go into details, but that molten lava rolling around creates a magnetic field. But that magnetic field pointing north and south, just like with your bar magnet, that doesn't necessarily line up with the exact spin of the Earth. So what's happened recently is the following. This is what Grist is saying, is that because there are a couple studies saying that because of the ice melt in the Arctic, okay, up at the North Pole, the ice melts, all the weight associated with that ice has redistributed. And since the Earth is essentially a spinning top in space, as that ice melts away, the top can begin to wobble a little bit. I mean, very slowly on a geologic, but that the way it's wobbling right now is the magnetic North Pole is basically marching slowly towards London, I think it was. I mean, not very fast and not very big, but it's discernible. And it's crazy to think that climate change could affect the spin of the Earth. Mm-hmm. Right? You look at this movie, Day After Tomorrow, right, with this crazy scenario of, you know, the whole Earth freezing up in 3 weeks or something. But still in all, it's a thing of stuff of science fiction to say that climate change is affecting the rotation of the Earth. I mean, mm-hmm. God knows what navigational systems depend on the position of the magnetic north.
So. The irony that Al Gore's book was entitled Earth in the Balance, because he sort of warned us about what would happen if we would have an Earth out of balance.
Well, you know, I mean, it's weird because I've seen other things at least suggest, now this is sort of conjecture, but it seems possible, that as some of these ice, as the ice melts in various places, it releases stresses on the tectonic plates that could themselves trigger earthquakes. Mm-hmm. Right? So if all the ice in the Arctic melts and all of a sudden Alaska is lighter and starts to rise, you got to figure that's not going to be good for the San Andreas Fault in the long run. Mm-hmm. That's just my imagination, but there you go. So we're all over the lot tonight, dear, huh? We got lots of things to talk about. Go ahead.
I was also going to note, speaking of ironies, you know, there was the report that Peabody Energy, filed for bankruptcy. And Climate Central noted that one reason why they filed for bankruptcy, and I found this to be deliciously ironic, is that because we've had a mild winter fueled by climate change, there's less demand for coal to heat homes. So in other words, the climate change that was driven by coal has put the coal industry out of business. It's like the snake consuming its own tail, basically.
Most people are not fully aware of it because they don't pay, you know, there's no reason to know these things. But Peabody Coal is a huge coal operation, has mm-hmm. been for a long time, right? And the idea that Peabody Coal would have to go into Chapter 11 really tells you a lot about the evolving energy, markets, right? Between mm-hmm. fracking and renewable energy and the sort of distaste for coal, I think, that's going globally, certainly in China. These huge behemoth companies that seem to be unstoppable are now going bankrupt.
Senator Sheldon Whitehouse had a speech this week, one of his Time to Wake Up speeches, where he noted that natural gas launched the actual war on coal. And I think you can say that Peabody Energy going bankrupt, I guess you can say that is natural gas's drone strike in the war on coal.
You are too poetic by far, dear. I think that you've got. So I got to say one more thing that's been on my mind. Just to sort of put this idea out for people to contemplate, is the following thing. For those of you who were at the MCAN conference a few weeks ago, you were fortunate enough to see Jane Klebb speak. And, of course, Jane Klebb was the leader of Bold Nebraska, which is one of the principal opponents of the Keystone XL pipeline. She was the keynote speaker and gave a very interesting presentation. But one of the things that she mentioned that I had not realized was that in Nebraska someplace or along the pipeline route, the proposed pipeline route, the activists had built a barn on the route of the Keystone XL pipeline as a protest, and that barn would have to be knocked down in order to put the pipeline through. And it would then be a symbolic confrontation, right? I guess it was Karl Marx or somebody said, some other philosopher saying, heighten the contradictions, right? Mm-hmm. They were going to make a confrontation with the Keystone XL pipeline at that point. And I thought it was interesting. But then this past week, I noticed a similar thing that's happening here in Massachusetts. There's a town called Ashfield, Massachusetts, out in the western part of the state, that has the proposed Kinder Morgan pipeline passing through it, or proposed to go through it. And what these folks did was to build a replica of the cabin at Walden Pond that Henry David Thoreau lived in for several years. Now, if you're a Massachusetts native, you probably are familiar with this, but if you're not, I mean, Thoreau's book about Walden is iconic, right? Anyway, look, you know, building a replica of Walden's, of Thoreau's cabin as a protest seemed really cool, and it got me thinking about the idea that in colonial times in the United States, colonists would plant what was called a liberty tree. It was typically an oak, right, or sometimes a pine. But these trees they'd plant them in the middle of town, and they were to represent the spirit of the community and the integrity and the strength and the hope for the future that the colonists had. And, of course, that is a symbol now. I'm sure if you go Google liberty tree now, you'll see many references. It occurred to me that the Thoreau cabin as an iconic symbol of the climate movement would be a really cool thing, because Thoreau's cabin represents simplicity, self-reliance, consistency with its surroundings, you know, sympathy with the surroundings, a gentle footprint. I mean, all the right stuff that climate hawks are about is embodied in that image. And I just think it's a great, I mean, I don't know how to go forward with it, but the idea of Thoreau's cabin as a symbol of the climate resistance movement seems to me like a good idea.
Absolutely.
So you heard it here first, DR. Tell me I'm crazy.
No, you're not. You're not. It's a great idea.
Well, there you go. If you're listening to this and you think I'm crazy, please tell me and tell me why. Okay, you can do that by putting a comment on the blog associated with this podcast, which will be at massclimateaction.net/blog. All right, please go there. Tell me why Thoreau's cabin should not be a symbol of the climate movement. You can find us on Facebook as well. It's /MassClimateAction. Please listen to our show and share us with your friends so that they can learn about us as well. You can listen to the show directly on your smartphone using Stitcher or TuneIn Radio. You can find us, of course, on iTunes by searching for Massachusetts Climate Action. So we'll close the way we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, because we believe it is our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the United States put a price on carbon. So thank you very much. Thank you very much for being here, DR.
Thanks.
And thanks to everyone for listening. It was great having you along. See you next week. Bye-bye.
Thanks for being with us. And until next time, be green.
Very cool.